Hello and welcome to the Late Kickoff Football Podcast. Spain stormed to victory over England in the World Cup final, while Aberdeen overcame Albion to set up an away quarterfinal tie with Ross County in a League Cup now without holders Celtic. Elsewhere, Kane opened his Bundesliga account in Bremen, the Saudis seduced more stars, and a fan ran the line at Fratton Park in just another wacky week in the world of football. But first, we'll start at the City of Manchester Stadium in the late kickoff, where an Alvarez arrow nailed Newcastle.
Now, Foden, in behind Byrne, Julian Alvarez, sight to goal, and that's all he needs! Manchester City's first attempt on target breaks the deadlock on the half-hour mark.
I'm Jamie Guyon, the host of the Late Kickoff Football Podcast, and joining me this week is Sheila. Sheila, how are you doing?
I'm not bad, yourself?
Yeah, not too bad at all, Nate. It's fantastic to see you in real life at the weekend. Makes a change than just on a Zoom call. And hopefully joining us at some point will be the preeminent Mike Wood, who is currently experiencing some technical difficulties. But hopefully he will be able to join in at some point. And that was Alvarez, his fantastic strike against Newcastle at the weekend that separated the two sides. It was a sticky fixture. Sheila, Man City probably deserved to win it. They largely nullified a Newcastle team that the week before had looked exhilarating.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that really comes as any surprise that the City were going to try and smother Newcastle. This is what they do better than anyone else is game management. They get the early lead and decide, oh, we'll just sit on it and see the game out. Because again, like first home tie for City, so I think that was obviously well in their favour that, you know, they weren't going to be the Newcastle team that is, and aren't going to be G'd up by the home fans, because I don't think it's really. Again, what was said last week, that Brentford are the hardest that we give in the Premier League, probably other than these two sides. So I think that, you know, City take home advantage this time to really make it count and see the game out, keep it nice and tight, nice and solid. I think Pep said something similar, that if they had played an open game, they would have got destroyed, something along those lines. Should we send his comments after the game? So I'm not sure it would have been that bad, but definitely didn't allow Newcastle to impose themselves in this game, which is what City do better than most.
Yeah, especially after having played midweek against Sevilla as well, abroad, in the heat. Going to penalties on that one. Going to penalties. So, and very few changes. And he made no substitutions, which is sort of becoming his trademark. But that's 17th consecutive home win for Man City, which is a club record. First league game without De Bruyne. It's hard to tell, isn't it, Sheila? Because I think for all the reasons you've just said, is that they obviously wanted to shut up shop a little bit and be pragmatic against a very excited Newcastle side. So it's hard to draw any conclusions as to whether they looked less adventurous or less creative without Kevin De Bruyne.
I don't know if it's less creative, but De Bruyne is an all-action player, so they will lose something from their team. Foden coming in and sort of playing the similar position, which I think is probably more suitable for him than either wing, to be honest. But I think probably Pep's probably prepared for this, in a sense that De Bruyne is not probably going to play the full 38, even if he was, like, you know, 100% fit, because his age, but he hasn't been 100% fit for probably 2-3 seasons now. He's always been like a kind of couple of months at least out injured, and City have managed to motor along fine without him. So again, it's
been in big games as well, like both Champions League finals.
Yeah, exactly. They won the Champions League final without him last year. So again, they're obviously keeping an eye on Paquetá to sign him, maybe potentially to do some of the things that De Bruyne can do. And try and cover that absence.
Depends if he's put a fiver on it or not.
Exactly. I was just thinking, time will tell whether that's a sensible option or not. Again, it's a City we're talking about here. They're not going to do anything silly.
It is interesting to see It will be interesting to see if they do anything in the transfer window, because at Man City standards, they've been reasonably quiet in this window, you would have to say. Vardy-Old, maybe the only big-ticket signing.
With FFP hanging over them, though, it was more about maybe they're shrewd enough to realise that we can't go out and spend hundreds of millions this window because we're being looked at anyway.
Well, Pep said he would be shot if he was Chelsea manager, which is maybe slightly extreme. Or shot if he was spending what Chelsea are spending rather than if he was Chelsea
In effect, has spent it at some point. Let's just not did he actually make signings? Like, all right, come on, let's. Haaland didn't come cheap or anything like that. So, you know, it's not as if City are just, you know, grown this team out of their academy and they're actually, you know, got a Burnley budget or something like that. You know, they have spent big in the past, but like it's proper. It just goes to show how well run the sort of football club is, at least from a football perspective. Like Mahrez goes and Alvarez all of a sudden gets a run in the team out in the right wing, scores in this game, and there's always Palmer, and he's always looked good when both of those guys have looked good coming off the bench. So it's just, and then Gundogan leaves, and Kovacic comes in, who kind of have a afterthought at Chelsea, but you reckon he's going to get a good run in the team for City, and Pep being Pep will probably get the best out of him as well. So yeah, they don't necessarily have to spend big to get success. That's how, that, as I say, they've already planted all those seeds and all that sort of thing. So it's just a kind of replace when needed, as opposed to, oh, we need to rejuvenate the entire team.
Because the point is they don't let
their team stagnate.
And that Pep's doing, sometimes people say, you know, what did Fergie do that has impacted on the game? And it was the fact that Fergie never ever stood still. That's what made him so brilliant. That's why he won so many Premier Leagues. It's because he was always changing that team. And he admits he makes mistakes in doing that. You know, Yap Stam's a prime example. But, you know, that was part of a wider philosophy that meant he was always improving. And we spoke last season, from a tactical perspective, how Arteta is doing what Pep did 5 years ago, but Pep's 5 years ahead of him now. He's moved on. He knows how to defeat that. And I think that's the same theory in his squad makeup as well. You expect them to maybe make a couple of signings yet, but he knows what he's doing. He's built that squad over time. The bench was interesting. He had James McAtee on the bench, who I think was on loan at Sheffield United last year, and Oscar Bob, who sounds like a Pez regen, a football manager regen, Oscar Bob. I don't know anything about Oscar Bob. I was just looking at their bench there to see if it was interesting. And Oscar Bob with two Bs, Norwegian footballer, born in 2003. Looks very much like Rico Lewis, short striker. Fair enough. Who's on their bench? Cole Palmer, Sergio Gomez, who's never really had a run in the team. Calvin Phillips. So yeah, pretty weak bench, but they didn't need it, did they? Because they beat the third or fourth best team in the league reasonably comfortably.
Yeah, it explains why it didn't make any subs. It's hardly the dream team to call upon. But no, again, City don't really need to make any signings, because effectively the replacements for the guys that left this season were signed last season. So, you know, like to pick, like, again, pick up boys like Akanji and Aki, and now this season Kovacic, and you see how well they fit into his style of play. It's like none of the other sort of big six sides would have been like, oh well, Akanji could probably come in and do a job for us and really elevate our game, whereas Pep obviously sees it differently, signs him for very little, relatively speaking. And then he fits into the side, no problem. So it wouldn't surprise me if Kovacic is along the same line this year.
Yeah, absolutely. Newcastle, on the other hand, I don't think they'll lose too much sleep at a 1-0 defeat at the Etihad at this point of their growth. They're maybe slightly ahead of schedule, but I think even the most optimistic of Newcastle fans probably doesn't have them as title challengers this season. They've actually got quite a tough run. They've got Liverpool at home, Brighton away, toughest away game in the Premier League, and then Brentford at home the weekend after that. That's three quite high energy There's a week in between for the that annoying international break you always get early in the season. But it's a tough wee run of fixtures that for Newcastle. It'll be interesting to see. We'll probably have a better idea of where they're going to be this season if they take 9 points from Liverpool, Brighton and Brentford, or if they come out of that with, say, 3 or 4.
Yeah, 100%. And again, I think we're not going to really gauge where Newcastle are going to finish this season until we've kind of seen them in the Champions League and how that bears out on things. Like, they have a kind of strong starting 11, but then after that, then it's like, you know what I mean? Like, and take a breath through the teeth, it's like, right, well, this is not going to be a top four challenges side. Like, there's still a few jobbers in there.
Did they give a contract to our favourite player?
Paul Dummett, of course they
Paul
did.
Paul Dummett.
I swear to God, I think they did.
We had a very long conversation at the end of last season about the fact that Paul Dummett was staying around.
So I think he's staying around for another year.
Fuck me, they've still got Matt Ritchie and Matt Target.
Well, exactly. You know what I mean? So the first 11 is pretty strong, but after that, you know, it's going to get threadbare fast. So,
and I haven't heard. He is still at Newcastle. I haven't heard that they've that they are really in for anybody else.
No, after Hall, I think it's a case of, I think Howe's come out right and said that, you know, we're FFP, we can't sign anybody else. It's like, well.
That'll be that then.
You know, it's just like, well, that is what it's there to do. So you can't come in with your
Saudi billions,
Saudi and oil money from your sugar daddy, and then just buy the league. So I suppose, I'll get it up. Yeah, that's what it's there for.
It will be fun to see them in the champ. I think the draw for the group stages must be next week or the week after. It will be fun to see them because we're only old enough to have sort of caught the very back end of Newcastle in the Champions League at very, very just. So, you know, potentially Newcastle against Real Madrid, Newcastle against Barcelona, Eddie Howe at the Bernabeu could be pretty bonkers. I was actually, slight segue, but Aberdeen play BK Hacking Thursday this week and next week. And we'll find out our group stage on the Friday. And if we qualify for the Europa League, we could end up with a group stage with Jose Mourinho's Roma. The idea of Jose Mourinho's Roma coming to Pittodrie is absolutely incredible. Mourinho standing in the dugout at Pittodrie, previously stood in by greats such as Darren Young and Jim Goodwin and Jimmy Crawford?
Jimmy Calderwood.
Which will be quite a laugh. But while City conquer, their Manchester rivals looked mangled at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium.
Here's Kulusevski. Pulled right across, deflected in, and Salah scores! What a moment for Pep Salah! His first goal for Tottenham!
Fantastic goal by Pep Salah. Some might say the most prized asset in draft fantasy football leagues up and down the country this week. Take a real coup if you were lucky enough to have got a hold of him. Spurs win 2-0. Ange Ball coming to the fore. Maybe slightly quieter first half for Spurs. Huge second half. Loads of talking points in this game, actually. You know, we sort of started with Man City Newcastle because it was the headline fixture of the weekend, but loads and loads of talking points in this game. Man United started reasonably well. Sheila probably looked the most likely to score, perhaps, in the first half. Perhaps I did have a chance, but in particular, Bruno Fernandes misses an absolute sitter. Rashford also missed an absolute sitter, although it would have probably been offside, but faded very quickly, and their midfield seemed to just sort of disappear into mush by the second half.
Kind of for the second time in a game, because they got away with one against Wolves, and they got away with like three or four against Wolves, and managed to nick it, really. And then Spurs kind of didn't really make that mistake, made sure to make the most of their chances when they came. But Man United is still a bit of a conundrum with them. It doesn't really feel like, you know, it's the finished article, really. Like, obviously, they've got Højlund to come into the team, and I think that will make a big difference, because Rashford, let's be honest, he's he can play as the you know, the centre forward, but it's not where he's most effective, and I don't know why. He's obviously one of their best players, maybe second only to Fernandes, probably. So why he's always the guy to be moved to different position rather than, you know, try and figure another way around it. Put him in his natural position and he'll probably be really effective there. And then worry about how the sort of, must be a young guy cutting about somewhere. Fucking even McTominay has experience up front. Put him up front, see how he does.
Even putting the putting an Antony or a Garnacho or that other guy begins with P. Put one of them up front. So at least, like you say, so at least Rashford's the one that's in his favoured natural favorite position.
Yeah, and it just feels like all the time that he doesn't really live up to it, and I think he takes a lot of it out of himself. Cuts a frustrated figure on the bench when he's subbed off, and it's like, right, well, I'm not being given the opportunity to do what I want to do. And that's probably the same for his entire Man United career, to be honest.
Yeah. He's always suffered from being that player that's a little bit too versatile, hasn't he?
Yeah. And I think, like, once that Hodgson, I keep what I call him Hoyland. So that's why I keep hesitating. But Hoyland, whatever his name is, once he comes in and then naturally Rashford can pull out to the left, then maybe we'll see what this Man United side could do. But yeah, just everything seems a bit disjointed at the moment. I think it'll click and we'll start to see it, but just right now it just feels like they're a bit hodgepodge.
Yeah, and I was surprised that they didn't really make any changes from the game before, because it was so obvious to everybody that watched it that they got away with one against Wolves, that Garnacho and Antony give the ball away so often. And then Fernandes and Mount didn't really work as a two in front of Casemiro, because neither of them offer Casemiro any protection whatsoever. I'd seen a stat, I think it was like half an hour into the game or something, and Mason Mount had 11 passes, which is the sort of midfielder in a team that you would expect to have the ball, just seemed bonkers low. Didn't really seem to manage to get himself into the game at all. Gave him a bit of a pass last week in his first game, but and it is still only a second game, but it's not looking hugely positive, because even if Hodgson does come in, Rashford does go to the left, it doesn't really solve that issue in the middle.
Right, it does solve like the midfield just getting run through. I mean, say what you like about Scott McTominay or Fred even, but at least, you know, they can stand in front of boys, just not all the time, whereas Mount or Fernandes is going to offer you that. And I think that's kind of par for the course for Mount. He always seems to be the second best player in whatever position he's told to play in. But it's always at like sort of the expense of someone better. Like, he'll get a game over someone that's better in that position for whatever reason.
He's another one that's almost too versatile. That was sort of his problem at Chelsea, that he started establishing himself in that sort of attacking front three, but he wasn't really a winger and he wasn't really a striker, so it felt a bit weird. And then Man United have bought him to be the number eight, but he's also not really a number eight. He's almost like an old-fashioned number 10 back when every team played 4-2-3-1, but nobody plays 4-2-3-1
anymore. Nobody plays that anymore, exactly.
And even then... Like you've just said, he's the second best player. Bruno Fernandes would be your number 10.
If you were going to play like that, then it would be Bruno Fernandes. And it's not, like, again, if you want someone to play a bit more, like, deeper and offer Casemiro an outlet, you've got Christian Eriksen there. Mm. So, once again, you've got a player who's more experienced doing that job. So, why would Mount really get the nod? So, yeah, that's another conundrum for Ten Hag.
He started last season poorly, I suppose it's worth remembering. And he managed to sort of get it to click. But I was going to say, the signs don't look great. The signs looked fucking terrible last season.
Brighton and Brentford. Much worse this time last year.
They were able to bring in Casemiro this time last year. He does look like he's aged 3 or 4 years over the summer. He's done a Ricky Hatton. It's like the closed season, and he's just been at the kebab shop every day. And now he's like, oh, you can't. Not only am I back in a Man United midfield, I'm the only one here because everybody else that I shared this midfield with last year's fucked off. So he is, and you know, I've seen some commentators saying the Premier League's really tough and that year's taken it out of him and now it's caught up on him and he'll be shite, which I don't agree with that. But like Duke for Aberdeen, he's just one of those players that fitness doesn't seem to come naturally to, and he needs to work at it. But it's obviously something to keep an eye on for United, because he does himself look to be physically off of it as well.
Yeah, I mean, he's been asked to do a bit more than he was this time last year. And that's something that needs to be addressed, really, that neither Mount nor Fernandes, whoever's playing alongside him in that midfield, just can't be in the free roam role. And again, with, as you've already mentioned them, Garnacho and Anthony not being able to keep a hold of the ball and, you know, just giving it away all the time, that's constant, like, right, pressure. Just, that's the thing, like, Man United don't really seem to be able to maintain possession in the football for any sustained period of time before it goes out to one of those two, and then you're right on the back foot, because that's where we've got most of their joy. It was like a breakdown of a Man United attack and straight away, like, boom, right up the pitch. So again, that needs to be addressed. If you did play Sancho, who does, again, more experience than either of those two boys, could maybe hold the ball a bit better and be a bit less naive with it, then maybe Casemiro wouldn't be under so much pressure, and the likes of Mount and Fernandes could maybe have more of an influence further up the pitch rather than try, you know.
And I wonder why this game, maybe they'll try it next game, they didn't try Mount in one of even the Garnacho or Anthony roles and to allow them to start McTominay, and just to see, because again, Mount probably isn't the ideal winger to have in your team, but he's going to keep the ball better than either of those two seem to be able to do in the first two games. And I know they're exciting and they want to take guys on, but there's got to be a bit of an end product to it. You know, there's been plenty of great wingers over the years that like to take guys on, but they can't lose the ball sort of two out of three times.
It's what separates good players from great players, isn't it? It's decision-making in key moments, whether it's, oh, should I just keep the whole possession of the ball or should I try and get the ball in the box? It really depends, really. Neither is correct all the time. It's just, you know, a great player will make that right decision at that time. It's like the pass isn't on, so I'll have to go back, rather than, oh, right, I'll try and get to the line.
I'll try and do a 360-degree ball spin.
Exactly. And again, the flashy stuff looks good when it comes off, but a lot of what Anthony in particular does just seems really ineffective.
He's filming a YouTube video most of the time.
Yeah, it's just doubly frustration. It's like, this is not what we need at this exact moment in time. You know, a step over, a dink of the shoulder, and you still end up going nowhere. Like, Premier League defenders are pretty good at what they do, so they're not going to fall for, you know, that shite that you're pulling in the park. Do you know what I mean? So,
exactly.
Again, that's really for them. That's for both of those players that were mentioned. That's really what needs to be next, is, you know, make the right decision at the right time.
Absolutely, and it's fine having one of them. As I guess at the moment, the issue is having them both. The other side of the ball, though, Ange Revolution is in full swing. 4 points in the first six, and they looked really exciting in this game. So they obviously did give up some chances, but had plenty of chances going the other way. Pap Sarr could have had a goal in the first half. There was the chance from outside the box that smashed off the bar, and then the cross that came back in through Luke Shaw's legs that smashed off the bar. And that sort of double pivot of Bissouma and Sarr just seemed to work brilliantly, caveated with the fact that we've just spent 10 minutes slagging off Man United's midfield for being shite. But it did look really good. They seemed to complement each other well, sort of one sat, one went, really high energy, connected defence to attack really well. And then you've obviously got Maddison, who's the kind of va-va-voom in that front four.
Exactly. I mean, you know, I can't sum up there. Just Bissouma and Sarr were all going to do the hard work and link everything together, whereas Man United did not have any of that. And that was the you know, where the midfield battle was won and lost, because Bissouma's, you know, we saw what he was, how good he was at Brighton. Again, an afterthought next year, and then Ange has identified him as a guy that, you know, he can really use, and that's what he's going to do. Kind of, you know, like I suppose a Callum McGregor, if you were going to compare him to what he was kind of doing up at Celtic, connecting everything together. Bissouma and Sarr are going to do that for Spurs, and Maddison will get to, you know, roam around in that, like, again, comparing to sort of the similar player at Celtic last year, like Aaron Moy or something like that, just that.
Or Hatate, even.
Just the extra man who can kind of roam around and do what he wants. And you know, that's how Ange wants to play football. And I hope it works out for him. I hope this is a sign of things to come, because he's a manager that I like and doesn't take any shit and tells it like it is for the most part. I mean, obviously every football manager waffles to a certain extent, but Ange kind of seems to cut through.
Seems to waffle less, doesn't he? Yeah.
Seems to waffle less.
Do you see his comment about fantasy football? That was quite funny. He was asked if any of his mates from Australia were coming to see a Spurs game. And he said, yeah, there's a group of them coming across, and he's really excited because, you know, they've been there with him on this journey now for over 20 years as a manager. He said, although he was furious because it's the first time in over 20 years he's had to pull out of their fantasy Premier League, their fantasy football league. And he said, but it's because the manager have taught them, isn't it? It's not a fantasy anymore. I am in the Premier League.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. 100%.
Yeah, it's quite humble of him. It's quite funny. And the other thing as well was Porro and Destiny and the fullbacks were marauding, as we've seen him do at Celtic. They were absolutely everywhere. Gary Neville seemed somewhat bewildered by what they were meant to be doing on Monday Night Football last night. And I think it was Mike that said, could he not have just watched one or two Celtic games for his research to find out what they were meant to be doing? Ange loves that. And Porro and Destiny, you know, look like two, I don't know how old Porro is, but certainly Destiny's like 19, 20, young, fit, athletic.
That old either.
I wouldn't have thought so. Young, fit, athletic.
Early to mid-20s, if anything.
Guys that are, he's 23, 24 in a couple of weeks, so pretty young. But athletic and fit fullbacks, it seemed to absolutely relish the opportunity to run up and down the touchline all game. And yeah, I'm sure there'll be big teams, you know, Man City, Liverpool might sort of spot that. But in most games in the Premier League this year, that's going to give them loads of options. And it's just must be great as a Spurs fan. I know we said it last week, but we'll probably say it every week. Imagine going from Jose Mourinho to Nuno Santos Costa to Antonio Conte, and then now all of a sudden you've got the Ange revolution where everybody just runs around like fucking madmen trying to score goals. It must be absolutely awesome as a Spurs fan. The only thing that doesn't seem to be clicking at all, Sheila, is Richarlison up front. He had a stinker probably for the second week in a row now. And he just doesn't seem to be able to get himself in the game. And I heard somebody say it's making that tattoo of the Brazilian greats he got on his chest of himself look a bit silly.
What was it? Yeah, of course. I mean, the worst tattoo in football, without a doubt. Without a doubt. But I don't know if Richarlison is really Ange's typical striker. Like, he's not Kyogo, let's put it that way. He doesn't play like Kyogo. Kyogo would always kind of get in between the centre backs, finding those little pockets of space, and, you know, quick turn finish, boom, there you go. How'd you like that? Whereas Richarlison's not really doing that for Spurs. He's never really been that type of player.
So he scored one goal for them.
He's only scored one. But even it's Everton or Watford days, that's not really what he was about. Like, so I don't know. Maybe this is just kind of, but I think they've not really got much option. They're going to have to stick with him for the time being, at least. But maybe next year they'll
they've got £100 million of Harry Kane money to spend. I didn't see that they were linked with somebody, but I'll be honest, it wasn't somebody I'd heard of. And so, classic when you try and find out what the name of the boy they're trying to sign is. All the articles that come up are fucking clickbait, so none of them tell me who it is in the headline. But yeah, they are trying to sign somebody, but he doesn't gift Orban or Moise Keane. Now, Moise Keane seems weird. I'm not sure how that's an improvement on Richarlison.
No, definitely not.
Another Everton striker that's not very good at scoring goals.
He's obviously Kulusevski and Son of a play with Harry Kane for the past however long, 2 years at least for Kulusevski. So, you know, that is really big shoes to fill if you're Richarlison, who's, you know, really struggled for goals at Tottenham, and every time he does score it, he really gets ruled out. So
he's had more bookings for taking his shirt off for goals that don't stand than he has goals.
Yeah. But again, look, there's two sort of difficult games he's had. All right, Man United not at their best, far from it. But Brentford the first week and then Man United the second. It's not a great sample size at this moment in time. Obviously still new into the Ange revolution. So give him a few more weeks and then we'll see whether he's worthwhile sticking with or probably.
Yeah, well, their next three games are Bournemouth, Fulham in the Cup, and then Burnley and Sheffield United. So you think the Bournemouth, Burnley, Sheffield United games before the North London Derby in the end of September will sort of determine whether he's likely to be, well, I guess by then you'll have to be because the window will be closed.
Yeah, but
but
whether they're going to, you know, bother signing someone else, someone better next season or in January.
Or Tony in January. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, Tottenham looked threatening at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. Chelsea creaked when it hammered.
Antonio brushing off Colwell. Antonio! Sacks the goalkeeper. And West Ham find themselves 2-1 up.
West Ham 3, Chelsea 1. I just realised we didn't talk about the Christian Romero and ball in the Man United game. We should probably do that very quickly. So we a little reel back to the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. Interesting one, Sheila. Most people probably thought it would have been given. Howard Webb didn't fancy it. I wouldn't have been surprised if it was given and quite glad to see that it wasn't.
Yeah, I mean, look, karma comes back fast, doesn't it? So Man United should have had a penalty against them against Wolves and they were denied one here. So again, football does have a weird way of balancing itself out over the course of the seasons. But again, like you, I think it wouldn't have been surprised if it was given. I'm not that bothered, but it's not because, again, justice has been done, I suppose, over the 2 weeks.
Yeah, absolutely. The bigger crime
is Fernandez is demanding an apology, though.
Demanding an apology despite being the guy that missed the header from 3 yards when nobody anywhere near him.
He's neglected to mention that
one. And got booked for dissent and bitching and moaning. And I've seen United fans saying that he will be unfairly targeted by referees for dissent this year. It's like, no, he's just a knob. That's why he'll be tagged. That's why he'll get booked a lot, because he's a fucking prick. He moans all the time. Moving forward again, West Ham 3, Chelsea 1. James Ward-Prowse, 2 assists in this game. West Ham obviously go down to 10 men on sort of the hour mark. Chelsea looked absolutely vibrant, attacking, exciting, creating chances in the first half, and then Enzo misses that penalty in the stroke of half time and they just seem to go flat. And it seems to be the same fucking story with Chelsea, that they're, you know, maybe slightly playing better than they did last year, but just not taking their chances at all. And the one guy that did take a chance is now out for 6 weeks after having knee surgery, Charlie Chukwuemeka.
Yeah, I mean, look, at least they are creating chances. They weren't last year, or at least for you know, good spells of last year. For all the signings they've made, have they really signed a proper number, like good finisher, a renowned finisher?
Like, and they've signed Nicholas Jackson.
He's a decent player. I like what I've seen so far, but he's just not that guy that you're going to be like, all right, he's only going to get one chance, he's going to take it. Probably not. And that's the thing with Chelsea. Nobody in their team that's like, right, if the ball falls to him, one chance needed, and he's going to score. It seems like they need
the hope, I guess, was obviously that would be Nkuku, who also joined Chelsea's long list of injury woes before the season started. But I did hear somebody break it. They were an angry West Ham fan, so you take it with a pinch of salt. But they sort of made some points where you break down Chelsea's, you know, this is a team that spent £1 billion, and you've got last season, you've got Brighton's number two goalkeeper is now Chelsea's number one in Sanchez. Colwell, who was a decent player for Brighton. Moises Caicedo, who was a decent player for Brighton, is now the most expensive British transfer of all time, when Declan Rice is looking absolutely extraordinary for Arsenal. You know, Jude Bellingham was 80 million. You know, it was £35 million. And I know you can't. I know they're real people, so it doesn't work like that. You know, Chelsea could not have signed Jude Bellingham even if they offered 115 million because he wanted to go to Real Madrid, and there's nothing you can do about that. But it is a bit worrying. And Cuckoo's now injured. James is injured again. Mudryk came in at half-time. Still doesn't look brilliant. He's really good at kicking the ball and running really fast, but doesn't seem to do a huge amount else. Just kind of ran out of ideas. Like, kept playing it wide and putting crosses in, and you've got, you know, Suchek and Zuma at the back for West Ham. It'll just mop up headers all day. And you needed somebody to start taking a few shots because, you know, you take a shot from 25, 30 yards, A, you might get a deflection, B, you might produce a save out of the goalie, but eventually the defence are going to have to come out and start closing the shots down. They can't just let you shoot from 30 yards because one of them will go in. These are good footballers. And they weren't taking any of those shots. So West Ham literally just sat on the 12-yard line for 30 minutes and you know, Caicedo gives away the penalty to top off a pretty dismal debut for him. Even him coming on seems a strange decision. You know, you're chasing a goal. Why are you bringing on a defensive midfielder?
Right. It doesn't make any sense. But that's when the policy at Chelsea doesn't seem to make a whole host of sense. £1 billion spent, but is it some of the names you just mentioned, like Caicedo? How can Caicedo be the highest, you know, British transfer record transfer fee in Britain? That's mental. Like, again, Rice held it for 2 weeks, and that kind of feels right. But like Caicedo, I think Chelsea have just been properly seen off by Brighton again. Like, again, relatively speaking, Tonali went to Newcastle.
80 mil.
If Chelsea had been more on the ball, they could have had him. I just think in football, see if you're, again, I've been a touch, like, sort of, seems like I'm writing Caicedo off straight away. I'm not. Like, he probably has potential, let's put it that way. I'll leave it at that. But, like, I've forgot my point now. Shit.
In football.
I'm back. In football, I think that if you are chasing a target and it doesn't materialise and things aren't moving at a good pace, you feel like you're being given the runaround, then back off and go to someone else. I think that's what City do. If they're looking at someone and they feel like they're being taken for a ride by whoever the selling team is, they just walk away and they go for other targets, whereas Man United post Fergie, Liverpool recently, Chelsea are all sort of going for these guys, and they're just like trying to get them on the cheap, and it's not working. The price is the price, pay it or don't pay it, and then it adds up pressure of the height to the point where it's like, oh well, maybe if we'd have just came off at like maybe 80 million straight off the bat, then Brighton would have went, right, you know what, fair enough, that's our asking price, we'll take it, rather than be like, 100 is going to cost you 115 million now.
Because you're Liverpool desperate. Have come in and now, exactly. We know you're desperate.
Now you're desperate. So that just goes to show, like, try and get your business done as quickly as you can and as in private as you can also. So I think that's just one thing that maybe the naivety of the new ownership, that, like, you know, try and get things done quickly because we're shrewd operators in this league. Everyone's trying to make as much money as they can. They're not going to just fall for cheap tricks. But again, just the other thing that bothers me is, and I know it's to try and skirt around financial fair play, but it's the 7 and 8 year contracts that all these boys are on. So I think I spoke here the weekend about that has to start translating into success quickly, or you're going to be stuck with these jobbers that no one wants for the next 8 years, and they're all going to be in monster contracts. So whilst FFP might not come and bite you in the arse within the next like 2-3 years, eventually that's going to mount up. You're not going to be able to sign anyone because everyone's on huge mega wage contracts.
They're not good enough, and you don't have the space because you've got sort of 10 amortizations still to run out. And
yeah,
you know, it looks like you've spent, Chelsea have probably already spent £100 million in 2030 because the way the contracts are set up. And you know, some people I've suggested as well, where's the motivation for the players? Now, you hope the players want to, and you assume most top players do want to win and win trophies and do well. But for some players, you know, that's an 8-year contract on £350,000 a week, like roughly £15 million a year or whatever it is. You know, that £150 million nearly, where's the motivation to keep doing it? That money's basically banked. You and your family are set for generations already.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And again, no one's going to be able to. Chelsea could quite easily end up with like 11, a dozen. How many signings he made? Like 24? Like
something
bonkers. Something, yeah. Like 24 Gareth Bales, where they don't want to move because their contract's quite comfy, you know, and no one can afford to, or no one's willing to spend the money to take that contract off them. So Chelsea will be stuck with all these players. But I think the most concerning,
there's only so long the Saudi league will keep buying them from us as
exactly.
Well.
Exactly, like you kind of, that kind of was like a golden opportunity. It was an open goal, right? You can get rid of some of these jobbers for good money, and you know, properly start again, like clear the books, and then it's just like, right, we're just going to replace them with more folk that are not the finished article. Because like, say what you want about Man United, they do have players that are the finished article. Like Rashford, probably at his peak, it's not going to get any better. But that's not a criticism. He's just
really good.
He's a footballer. Yeah, he's good. He's
Bruno Fernandes.
Fernandes really the same. Yeah, like Son Heung-min, for example. City have everybody is pretty much the finished article. But there's
Liverpool have Salah, Van Dijk,
Salah, Robertson. Exactly. Whereas who the fuck did Chelsea have? That's our guy.
Yeah,
that's, you know, Reece, gonna be like,
it's the fullbacks, Reece James and Chilwell. But
I wouldn't
James
even put Chilwell. I wouldn't put Chilwell in there. I think Chilwell was more hot and cold. Reece James for sure. But mate, as you say, he's made it a broken biscuit. So what use is that? He spent most of the time on the treatment table, and it's not the Chelsea that we've been used to over the past like, 20 years or so, where like Drogba's our guy, Lampard's our guy. McAleely, these guys who, you know, would like walk into any of the other big six sites, or you know what I mean? So it's just like now
we've got Robert Sanchez, and we've spent £350 million on Mudrik, Enzo, and Caicedo. Like, you're like, boys need to be good, like really, really good.
they do, exactly, and that's the point. They're all kind of very raw, and you know.
The only saving, sort of the positives are there. They are playing good football, so you hope it might click. Pochettino is clearly a very good coach. I think Andros Townsend said on Match of the Day that he really heavily focuses on coaching players to make them better. And yes, he wants to win, but he knows if you drop points early in the season, that later in the season you'll make them back by playing well, by being better players, by being fit. So you hope that works. And sort of long term, you hope that by these young players, your Enzos, your Caicedos, your Mudriks, Nkunku when he's back, by being around a Poch, they will all get better and they'll get better together. It's just, I think what's actually maybe slightly unusual with it being Chelsea as well is Arsenal did this sort of 3 years ago, and you're like, well, fair enough, it's Arsenal, it's all they can do. They've kind of got to try and do something like that, build for the future long term. I think we're so used to Chelsea being, for 20 years, being a here and now. Every summer, it's here and now. Who can we sign for right now? What manager's going to win us a cup right now? And we might actually be in a finishing fourth to eighth for 3 years before we end up in Arsenal's position.
Exactly. And I think that's pretty much just got to accept that fact now. But again, the concerning thing for Pochettino, or for Chelsea fans generally, is, you know, Graham Potter was supposed to be that guy.
Yeah.
And he was binned after, not even six months in the job.
Yeah.
6 months.
But he was called Graham, remember.
Yeah, that's true.
Poch is called Mauricio, so it's
yeah. So it's a bit more, you know, sort of attractive. But again, that's the concerning thing for me: is this guy going to be given afforded the time, given the amount of money that's been spent?
And they can't do it again. Like there does become a point where you need to stop spending $350 million.
Exactly. Pounds. Yeah, there will come a point, and again, there will also come a point where, you know, you can't keep sacking your manager. So something's got to give at Chelsea at some point. They've got to stop winning games. They've got to start winning games, or they've got to accept the fact that they're going to be in Arsenal's position, or the Arsenal of 3 years ago's position. Yeah.
It's a massive, massive game on Friday night. A 6-pointer, you'd argue, against Luton to try and avoid potential relegation for Chelsea there early in the season. West Ham, good debut for James Ward-Prowse. Sheila kind of did exactly what they signed him to do.
Yeah, take corners, take kicks. Yeah, that sort of thing. The pass to Antonio for his goal was pretty up there as well. But I mean, obviously, Antonio still had a lot to do and did it with aplomb as well. So, but other than that, you know.
Kicked it really fucking hard, didn't he? Like, did really weirdly it, hard.
Like, it's really precise too, which is hard and precise. That's not really like words you associate with Antonio's finishing very often. It's either one or the other, but it's not rarely both. But anyway, yeah, Ward-Prowse kind of, again, I don't understand why other teams have kind of fell asleep on him, in the sense that he only cost $30 million from Southampton. That feels like a bit of a bargain, and other teams higher up the league, and probably West Ham, could have picked him up. Like even, dare I say, like a Liverpool could have used him.
But even Brighton and Brentford, who are further up than West Ham, even
Newcastle, I'd suggest could do with Ward-Prowse. I mean, who have they got at the moment? Obviously, Bruno, Joelinton, and Tonali. But Ward-Prowse offers you a little bit something different from those three. Because again, as we've said before, after that, who have you got? Fucking Longstaff.
Our Newcastle fans fucking love. I heard one of them saying it shows how strong they are this season that they've got a player like Matty Longstaff on the bench. And I was like, what? Does it?
Yeah, aye, that's a head scratcher, right enough.
He was like, who drove us into the Champions League last year? And I was like, I maybe didn't watch Newcastle as closely as you did, but that strikes me as some black and white tinted glasses there, if I've ever heard
definitely,
it.
Definitely. Yeah, so I don't know why so many teams probably have slept on that. The same could be said for James Maddison at Tottenham. Although Tottenham are a fairly big side, but a lot of clubs could have used him. But anyway.
Man United signed Mount, and they could have got Maddison for £20 million less. Yeah.
And I'd probably rather have had Ward-Prowse than Maddison than Mount, rather than Mount, to be honest.
Arguably, yeah.
Obviously, that's just maybe recency bias. But yeah, good piece of business, I'd say, from David Moyes.
And they're in Europe again, so they, you know, picking up wins early in the season is important for them, because I suspect they might still struggle.
Quite a while. Yeah. We're worried for quite a while, but I think they'll be all right. I think there's enough about them, and they're like to pull away from that relegation zone a lot quicker than they did last year.
Yeah, absolutely. Moving on, there were six other ties in the Premier League, starting with the Villans' vivacious victory over Everton. Thanks, Mike, for that one.
Watkins waits in the middle. Bailey looks to find it. Nicking Firth home! It's brilliant from Bailey, the way he dances past Ashley Young. And then John McGinn, at times he'll play out wide. But when the ball goes to the right, he will tuck in. He'll take up a striking position. He does that here, and it's a simple finish for him.
Fantastic win for Villa. Mike said in the comments on this one, both teams looking like the side they did last season. Everton pish Villa back to where we'd expect to see them. I'd be really worried if I was an Everton fan, Sheila. They look really shit.
They do.
Well, we leave it there and move on.
That's what I can't say anymore other than that. Like,
You know that Alex Iwobi's injured and it might literally be like season defining for them. How bad do you have to be? We just said, if you said Matty Longstaff being on the bench shouldn't be a sign of being good. Like Alex Iwobi being injured and that being bad is very much a sign of being shit.
Like Calvert-Lewin, again, didn't last either.
A poor bastard, not even a leg injury, just his face gets fucking smashed in. Most Calvert-Lewin thing that could possibly happen, not even a proper injury, and he comes off looking like a hamster. Hopefully he can get a Batman face mask and be back fairly quickly. But
well, let's hope so, because they're gonna need something.
I also argue whether he's even that good. I know you could say it's hard to tell because he's spent the last two and a bit seasons injured.
Well,
but
he might not be that. He's definitely not going to be the same player that he was, what, two, three?
He was only good for 12 months, and he was good under Ancelotti, who's arguably one of the best managers of all time. Like, neither wonder he was good. I'm not sure Sean Dyche has necessarily got the... Maybe I'm doing him a disservice.
You are doing him a disservice. But
Dyche-nio.
It is. They just seem like I couldn't even, other than Pickford, maybe Tarkovsky. Who's the other centre back?
Keane.
And then after that, like, you got Wobey. After
who's
that,
injured, so they're fucked. So they got Dwight McNeil.
That, oh Jesus, peeps, man.
They got Ashley Young playing fullback, man.
Yeah, they're really
young by name,
really
fucking ancient by nature.
Yeah, they're really struggling in the transfer market for one reason or another. They can't.
Because they did a Chelsea about 10 years ago. Kept spending tens of millions of pounds on shite.
On jobbers. Exactly. So now it's all caught up with them and they can't sign nobody. I mean, Villa away is not an easy game. And yet I think Villa will do this to a number of sides who are not really at it, especially after they kind of got a humbling of Newcastle the week previous. So it's kind of like Emery wanted to make a point that last week was just a fluke and not good enough and unacceptable from the players moving forward. And Everton were just unfortunate to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. But yeah, I think given what they've been through the last 2 years with Frank Lampard for most of that time, it's not going to get any easier. And then if you get rid of Sean Dyche, then who do you turn to?
Exactly. And I still like harbour a dislike for Everton because I keep thinking that Frank Lampard's still there, and then remember that he's not. But they're playing like a Frank Lampard team at the moment. That team, I don't know if it's just because I recognise the names so much or what. The team doesn't even seem that bad. Like the midfield three that started this game are Onana, Gay, and Doucouré. You know, Doucouré's been decent for a few years. Onana was tipped. You know, Chelsea looked at him in January. It's not necessarily a sign that you're any good. But James Garner, I suppose, starting on the right. Nathan Patterson's never really shown any genuine Premier League ability at right back. And then bringing on players like Neil Mopai, Arnaud Danjuma, and then the other two, I don't know. So that is, even their injury list, Coleman's injured, Andre Gomez is injured. They've only just signed Jack Harrison and he's injured. Dele Alli's injured, Dwight McNeil's injured. It does say Damari Gray, but he's now away to Saudi, isn't he? So they'll not have him anymore. Worrying times for Everton. And in previous years, we've said, oh, they should be fine because I think there's three worse teams than them. I think this is the season where there might not be three shite teams. Yeah. You know, they're really relying on Sheffield United and Luton falling away and then just hoping that they can drag somebody else into it because... they look in big, big danger. Good to see Villa back, kind of, like you said there, Sheila, back to normal, so to speak. Wolves 1, Brighton 4. Wolves again, plenty of attacking threat in that first half, and then Brighton scored, 3 in 10 minutes at the start of second half and just completely swat them aside. Brighton have just picked up exactly where they left off last year. Looked thrilling, and Sisco looked absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah, and he didn't even start the week previous. So, they've plenty of room to chop and change when, as and when they see fit, which is like kind of, you feel like it suits De Zerbi. If he's not feeling a particular player, he can drop him out. But at the same time, the player realises that it might just not be their day as far as starting or getting on is concerned. They might get on, they might be better for another opponent. So it seems like a really nice sort of, you know, Brighton feels like they've got a squad of 23 rather than, you know, an 11 and some fringe players. Feels like everybody is going to get a run in the team. And I think that's really beneficial for everyone. And Cisco comes and didn't start the week before, might not start next week, probably will the week after. And it's class to have that sort of, especially when we've got a team that's so young as well, that no one's going to get burned out. And again, as we've said before many times in this podcast, eventually teams start to figure you out. But if you're constantly changing the lineup, then you delay that. Then
you've got Welbeck starting up front, but even that could be João Pedro next week, or it could be Evan Ferguson. Like you say, you've got Encisco, you've got Estepinian, these guys who are 18, 19 years old and really exciting and just seem to be free flowing. I still think they've got the look of a team that could get thumped 5-1 by Everton but
they do again. Like, it could have quite easily been this game if Wolves have taken their chances, but
in the first half, absolutely. Wolves, on the other hand, just kind of nothing too thrilling yet. The main talking point for them is Matias Nunes, clearly, even though there was 60 seconds to go, was desperate for a shower as he started laying boys out in the Brighton box.
Never done since the Royal Rumble in 2001, where Kane just chucking every cunt out. Have I seen such a display? Just swatting Brighton. Like, you know that, like, it's like a meme where it's like a slap, so the people just keep coming towards him. Yeah. Just keep slapping him. That's what it was like. Fuck you.
The keeper goes down, he shoves a big dunk over the goalie, then bends the full back.
They land like right next to each other. Yeah. They're both like, look up, like, fuck you, then.
I know, and his first booking was was it chucking? It was like time waste or chucking the ball away. It was something really petty as well. It was just like, for fuck's sake, you know, especially if you had him in your fantasy team, then you were particularly pissed off that he got himself sent off and got you minus 10 points. Fulham 0, Brentford 3. Mike said, no Tony, no problem. That's Wissa and Mbeumo just on this frightening run as a pair up front, scoring game after game without Tony. They're looking exciting again. Fulham, however, I tipped them to do quite poorly this year, and Mitrovic has now gone to Saudi for 50 million, and they aren't showing anything in those first two games that would give you any confidence that they are going to be where they were last season, Sheila.
No, because Mitrovic was a big part of why they finished so high up the table last year.
They were lucky to win against Everton, you would say, last week.
What do you do if you're Fulham again? If we are saying that Everton are relying on a team that's three teams that are worse than them, Fulham could well be one of them. They offer.
But it could be the Fulham and Everton could be the 17th, 18th battle that Everton are desperate for.
Yeah. And again, they have similar problems to Everton. It's just you don't really know where are the goals going to come from? Where are the defensive performances going to come from? And again, at least Everton have that. And they, you know, Tarkovsky's a very good Premier League defender and will make things that keep things tight for you. It's like, to a decent level. Did Fulham really have that? I'm not so sure they do. Really don't. They definitely don't have the manager that can do that to the same level. So I think,
I think they're still waiting on Paulinho to come back in, aren't they? Which obviously will make a big difference in the middle of the park.
Not at the top of the park, as Mike says in his notes here. No Mitro, big problem. Yeah. Who can they get to replace that? I'm not really sure.
Liverpool 3, Bournemouth 1. This was an exciting game. Bournemouth disallowed goal after 2 minutes, then scored after 3 minutes. Liverpool come back. The McAllister red card. Mike has said in the notes, still papering over the cracks of this comeback. Alisson drops one of these games roughly every 6 months when he just fucking loses his mind. You know, he gives away the goal that's disallowed and he's lucky as fuck. Then he gives away the goal. And then he's like, 20 yards out from goal, wiping out Bournemouth wingers. And I think was it Trent or Robertson that was on that side? It must be Trent. I think even Trent's looking at him like, "The fuck are you doing? Like, I'm right here. This is my position." Like, the last thing I expected was to see you fleeing out, absolutely wiping the boy out. And Liverpool got away with it. You know, when Alisson has these cataclysmic clangers, then you need things to go your way. The one thing that didn't really go their way was the Alexis McAllister red, which has now been rescinded on appeal. I think you said, Sheila, when we discussed it, you thought it was a bit harsh.
Yeah, it was. I don't think there was any particular malice or that involved in it. I don't think it was what was it, sent off for serious foul play? I don't think so, really. Didn't really endanger the opponent that much. Was kind of in control. I think it was just one of those things. Just unfortunate.
But yeah, I think the referee just didn't have a great view of it. And then we've discussed last season, I think the VAR threshold for the referee to look again is just so high. And Howard Webb said this. I listened to The Rest Is Football, the Gary Lineker and Mika Richards podcast, and Webb was saying, you know, the test, you know, we want the test to be really high. We don't want it to be re-refereed, which I think sounds good in theory, but I genuinely think it's that causes some of these slightly odd ones where...
Yeah, because it does feel like that's why VAR is there, to to give the referee like a chance at another look at it. I'm not saying like referee games in the sense that like take the decision out of the referee's hand, but if the referee feels like it could go... Like, again, that's what VAR is supposed to be. There's another...
Especially when the game stopped.
The decision.
You know, it was a bit like the Onana one last week. The explanation that was given for that was that the VAR thought that you've got the Wolves attacker and Onana, neither of them win the ball, and then they clatter into each other. And, you know, there's a theory to that. Sometimes that happens, two players miss the ball and hit each other. In that circumstance, it was so fucking obvious that Onana's run 5 yards as fast as he possibly can to fucking poleaxe the boy. It was a clear foul. And then this one, I think, like, yeah, you know, there are tick boxes there. His foot's flat, his studs are showing, he's late, he catches the boy quite high. But as you've just said, is there excessive force? Probably not. Is he endangering the safety of his opponent? Probably not. And I just think, but if you're the VAR, you're maybe looking at that and going, well, his foot is up, he has caught him with his studs, the referee's seen it. You know, what have you seen? Oh, I've seen him catch him with his studs. Yeah, fair enough. Okay, that's kind of what's happened. Fine. Whereas, I wonder if you get the referee to go and look at that again, he goes, oh, fucking hell, it's nowhere near as hard as I thought it was when I watched it in the game. And he maybe changes his mind. I think the clear and obvious error bit should be for the referee. That should be the threshold that the referee himself adheres to. And the should you go and take a look at it threshold should be, I think you've got that wrong. It doesn't have to be like, I think you've had an absolute fucking clanger. Just, yeah, I think exactly. You've got that wrong. You go decide.
You fucked up big time here. Yeah, exactly.
Like, which is what he should have said after the Onana one, to be fair. He should have been like, oh, you can't, mate.
Screaming like, whoa, what are you doing that? No, wait till you come and have a look. Right. That sort of thing. But yeah, again, it just feels like that's the confusing thing with VAR and how it's trying to be implemented. It's just like, oh, what's the threshold? It's like, again, it's supposed to be a tool to come for the referee to come to the correct decision. If he wants to go and have a look at something, he should be more than it. Like, VAR should get involved for... Well, it does, but like, I mean, if you should go and have a look at every red card decision I get, really.
I tell you what would make VAR a wee bit better. It's instead of the referee having to do the screen and jog slowly over to the VAR screen, it'll be a bit awkward. Is have a referee like physio with a half decent iPad, like a 15 inch iPad, and he just fucking comes pelting on. The referee doesn't have to move, gives him the iPad, he has a look, goes, yeah, that's a penalty, and then iPad boy runs off again. It's much better than going to a stupid screen, surely.
I think it should be that if a decision is clear and obvious and it's such a clanger that they should appear in a big titatron like in the wrestling. Absolutely embarrassed. Like, that's Vince McMahon's music plays, and Howard Webb comes out and says, "Well, here's something from earlier." And then
I was gonna make my other suggestion was instead of a physio bringing out the iPad, you could have, you know, the little VW car that they had at the World Cup to bring the ball. Just have my boy bringing that out with the iPad on it.
Just like a wee ball boy, a tiny wee ball boy.
I do think that especially when the game is stopped, there's an opportunity to use the screen more and the referees to still feel confident that it's them making the final decision and to stick with it. You know, like the Christian Romero one, I don't think you need to have another look at that. I think Michael Oliver knows exactly what he's seen. He had a completely clear view of it and he's not given it, and I think that's fine. Whereas the McAllister one did look a lot more. I was surprised just watching Match of the Day that I just assumed he went to the screen and stuck with his decision. I was surprised to see that he didn't go to the screen. The other decision in that one was the Wi-Fi password winning a penalty. Dominic Szoboszlai went down a wee bit easy. Sheila, probably annoyed if it's against your team, screaming for it if it's for your team, one of them.
Yeah, it was, because I mean, having said that, the Bournemouth players didn't really make much of a fuss about it. They just kind of like, oh, fuck, right, I've given them an opportunity here. Like, there was contact. Yeah, it's not a hell of a lot of contact, but they're giving the referee a decision to make, and it's kind of like, right, he's done me there, because it is a nice intricate piece of skill to kind of get the ball around and then get, but like, obviously he's just managed to get into the box in a nice, like, sort of heel click away from the defender. And it's just the defender's trailing leg that catches him, and it's enough for a penalty. Because I think, you know, you'd probably say it was definitely a foul anywhere else in the pitch without
quick. Yeah, exactly. It's kind of one of them. It looks a bit soft because you get an opportunity to score the goal.
Again,
for
that's what VAR's really there for. So if there was any reason to go look at it, they could. So
no, I agree with you. I think it was just a pen. It was just a bit. I think the commentator was like, "Ah, he's gone down far too easy. Oh, I didn't expect to see that given." Like, it was one of them. It was a foul. It's just like you say, anywhere else in the pitch, no one's losing any sleep. It's just because they basically get a free goal out of it. Although, to be fair, is it Neto and goals for Bournemouth? Some fucking save from the penalty, by the way. I felt really sorry for him that Salah then just waltzes up and taps it in, because I was like, that's a fucking great save. And he's like looking at his defenders like, are you lot fucking joking? Did you not just see what I did? And there's not a single one of you is here to mop it up for me. I did feel for him a bit there. I think there was another one where he made an absolutely incredible save, and the ball still ends up in the back of the net, and you're like, fucking poor bastard could have had a clean sheet today. And instead he's been beaten 3-1. Forest 2, Sheffield United 1, Wood with the crucial header in the strange Friday night kickoff that wasn't actually on telly. Forest made hard work of this, Sheila. We were sort of in the pub when it was on live, tracking it, and surprised that Sheffield United kept themselves in it. And then watching the highlights on Match of the Day as well, the Forest looked like they should have been kind of out of sight, and Sheffield United dug in and kept themselves in it. But I suppose for Forest at this stage of the season, just another win's quite good for them.
Absolutely. It could be a crucial 3 points come the end. I mean, you know, this would be one of that. Maybe both teams for sure, but definitely Forest would be identified as like, right, we need to get 3 points out of that one. Especially being early on in the season, you don't really know what Sheffield United are going to do. But yeah, get those 3 points on the board easily, because Sheffield would definitely be like, all right, well, maybe Forest are one of the teams that are a bit more on our level, so we need to kind of get something from that game. But I think Paul Heckenbottom's time is
already numbered.
Quotes on
a Mike said three games, didn't he, and he gets sacked.
I think he'll get more than three, but yeah, not much more than
three and a half. Sacked at half time in the fourth game. It's not looking great. I'm not really seeing anything, and they play Man City this weekend, which
could be embarrassing.
Has the potential to be silly.
It's mental that Paul Heckenbottom's in a. Guardiola won't be in the dugout this week. It's just had surgery on his back, so he won't be.
He's missing two games or something.
Paul will be. Probably like mark that in his. Like, circle that. Get to share the dugout with Pep. Pep's not there, like, fuck's sake, so I'm just going to get pumped for no reason.
Pumped for no reason, and I'll be sacked by the time we play them again. Nothing from Sheffield United is making me think they're a team that can stay up here. No,
that's definitely what, you know, one worse than Everton. That's a threshold. Are you worse than Everton? If you are, you're probably not.
You're absolutely, yeah. I think we said, did we say last, we said, I remember us saying something like, whoever finishes above X will be in the Champions League. I think whoever finishes below Everton will have got relegated this season. Because there'll only be two or three teams that finish below them. And then Monday night, Crystal Palace 0, Arsenal 1. Dogged sort of second half from Arsenal here to dig in and take away the victory. The big talking point was the Tomiyasu red card. Sheila, first one for delaying, second one for being a wee bit silly.
If anything, I think Havertz should probably have been booked for the time wasting, because he held the ball on for a long time before passing it off to Tomiyasu. And I genuinely think that Tomiyasu was just looking for an option.
Yeah,
because Havertz had taken the piss for so long, it was a very harsh booking. The second one you can really have no complaints about.
Yeah, I've seen people saying, "No, it was ridiculously soft." I just don't agree. Like, no, he's put his hands on the player as he's about to run away, and the boy's gone down. It's like, just why have you done that? Why have you touched his hip and pulled his hip? Whatever you've done, it's just silly.
But it's this kind of challenge you would make if you went on a yellow. But being on a yellow, you're probably just like, Africa. You know what? I'll just try and get back in position. But and he was miles away from the goal, so it's not like it was a goal. Like, he was bearing down on the goal. And if he was on that. Jordan Ayew, so...
No chance he's going to score. If anything, he should have been like, that's upset. I'll just actually fucking stand still. I don't even need to worry about slacking him back.
Yeah. So it's slightly harsh to pick up the first yellow, but it is what it is. Like, the players know now that...
Sort of the last one on the scene, wasn't it? It was like, because you had Partey from the goal kick, took the piss, and he got told off by David Coote. And then you've got Havertz... takes a piss, gives it to Tomiyasu, and he's the last one holding. He's the one holding the parcel when the
because he doesn't instantly throw it away. Like, he's looking for an option. What was I going to say here? Oh, have we glossed over this? But see, for the fourth, I've gone quite a fair back now. But on throw-ins,
the Everton, Everton game.
What the fuck was that about?
Ashley Young.
I have never seen a worse throw-in in my life.
I did see a comment from a few Everton fans saying, did he forget, you know, he is getting old. Did he forget he doesn't play for Aston Villa anymore?
Yeah, exactly. Because I can't remember who he's trying to throw it, but the guy is fucking miles away. Like, Ashley Young's like, you know, no Superman. So he's not going to throw it that far. He just throws it directly to him.
Yeah.
Like, it was just the most bizarre way to concede I've ever seen.
When somebody had said, oh, there was an assist by Ashley Young with a throw-in, I thought before I'd seen it, it was going to be like, you know, like when the substitute warming down gives the ball to the striker and then thinks, oh, fuck, why have I done that? And they take a quick throw-in and it's a goal. I didn't think he was literally just like, he actually plays a through ball with a throw-in to the Villa boy who's standing right there. It was a bit complete lapse of concentration from him there at the end. That wraps it up for the Premier League ties. No massive transfer news. Maybe the big one, Sheila's Nicolo Zaniolo signing for Aston Villa, former Serie A Young Player of the Year, prior to two cruciate ligament injuries. But was still touted heavily at Roma, but kind of had a massive bust up with the fans and ended up being shipped off to Turkey. It was that last year. But only 24, and certainly the potential was there at one point in his career. So I suppose Villa fans will be hoping that he can kind of just add a little bit of creativity to their central midfield.
Certainly, yeah. More depth, which, you know, if you're going to push for the European spots, it's what you need.
And they're in the conference.
They are in Europe. So again, these kind of boys will help.
And they've got the king of Europe in the dugout, so they're going to go far.
Absolutely. So they are going to need, you know, backups, reserves for the league.
Absolutely. We should touch on the Mason Greenwood decision. I don't think we need to give it loads of time. We've obviously discussed it in quite a bit of detail up until now, and there's lots and lots of good reporting on it. I was going to say shout out, as if he needs a shout out from me, but particularly Adam Crafton of The Athletic and on Twitter has done a phenomenal job on keeping top of this over the last week. It was revealed last week, Sheila, that United's chief exec had told staff to prepare for his reintegration. That's obviously then leaked, and then there's a backlash. Following that, it was then announced that Man United had drafted a list of stakeholders and whether they were hostile or friendly, which included domestic abuse charities who were assumed to be hostile. Then Man United released their own statement saying that they hadn't made a decision contrary to the reports, and that they were examining the wrath of evidence that wasn't in the public domain. So then instantly you were like, well, here they go laying the groundwork for their excuses. Now, the overall backlash over the weekend has led them to, on Monday, announcing that he will leave the club by mutual termination. They haven't said how, they haven't said when, they haven't said it'll be a transfer, if it'll be a loan. They certainly haven't said his contract is going to be terminated. Greenwood's then released a statement, mainly full of waffle, but saying a few weird things. You know, he said he was cleared of all charges, which is technically legally incorrect. He wasn't the witness pulled out. That's very different to going to trial and being found not guilty. But it's a technicality, but it felt that in a statement that was clearly drafted by a lawyer, that wasn't an accidental sort of misstep in terms of speaking about the technicalities. And that, you know, he didn't do the things he was accused of doing, which felt like a really strange thing to say when we've all seen the videos and heard the audio and
but
stuff.
But it was the bit that got me was the, but I have made mistakes, and inverted commas, like, well, what are these?
Aye, do you mean mistakes? These mistakes or different?
What mistakes are you taking responsibility for? So, I mean, you can't have it, like, for me. And then Man United said similar things, like, oh yeah, he's taking responsibility for the mistakes he has made, and it's like, well,
you've just said he didn't do it.
What
he didn't
mistakes
do them.
Are you referring to? Yeah, so like, again, that was never, again, I think the ones that have come out in support of Greenwood and were hoping he was going to be brought back at the team, that's what they had in their hats on. It's like, oh, he was cleared, he was never convicted, blah blah blah. So I think that's maybe why, sadly, both Man United and Greenwood have kind of been fast and loose with the word cleared. Because it's like, they're not going to say, oh, well, charges were dropped, they never actually made it to trial, so, you know, we'll never know, type thing. But again, it's just all very vague, and it's like,
it's just depressing. It's morally depressing, isn't it?
Yeah, like, it's like, there's evidence that's not in the public domain, and again, like, but we can't reveal that. It's like, well, why not? There's no ongoing trial. You can say whatever you like, and no one's going to.
As long as you keep her lifelong anonymity for making the initial complaint, then you're absolutely
But we already know who she is because she put it on social media and all that sort of thing anyway. But anyway, that's by the by, like, I'm not having a go at her, far from it. But again, and then it's just like, oh, but even the initial, like, oh, we've not actually come to a decision, it's like, oh, he's a father.
He's a young man, like, and we're supporting. We feel like we have a duty of care towards him because he's been at the club since he was seven. And even that's telling in itself, isn't it? Because yes, you do have a duty of care to him, and he has been at your club since
he
was seven.
Do you? But do you though?
Generally during his whole career, they have. So from a 7-year-old to a 20-year-old. My point is though that you've already failed in that. Like, you've already failed because he's behaved the way he's behaved. You should have taught him to behave better 5 years ago. Don't suddenly get all fucking moral. We've got a duty of care to him now. That's your own feeling.
Like, our teachers had a duty of care to us till we were about 18. Then we were adults, and that duty of care probably ceased as soon as we left school. Mason Greenwood's an adult. You know what I mean? So the duty of care, like, all right, it's not like, you know, training a 16-year-old and, you know, he's got lost or something like that. Like, you know, we've misplaced him. Like, you know,
it's really bad. And this idea that we had to carry out a full and thorough investigation to find out whether he had done the things he was accused of. You're like, you know, when we find out he hasn't, you think, how fucking low is the threshold? But he hasn't actually attempted to rape someone, so we'll keep him.
Exactly.
Like, how fucking low is that bar to be able to keep your job? Like,
and again, if it was the kit man or one of the cafeteria workers, they'd have been binned immediately, and it would have been by the by. But it's just, they just,
and then the fact that they haven't just actually terminated his contract immediately, despite this. And I've seen people saying on Twitter, talking out their arse. Oh, it's actually really complicated to terminate a contract legally when somebody doesn't want it. Like, mate, 13 football managers were sacked last season. It's not that fucking hard, is it? Do you think they were sacked by following a fair and thorough process? Do you think Brighton are getting out disciplinary proceedings and Chelsea are going through grievances and whatnot to find out if they can get rid of Graham Potter?
Because they were shite at their job for underperformance. So surely, Christ, that...
Well, not even... My point is it's not even that, because they wouldn't have even investigated it.
But, like, yeah, I know just, what you mean, but like,
they've chucked a settlement agreement in front of their face and said, "There's a million quid. Fuck off."
Exactly. So it would have been easy for Man United to get it, and that's the silly thing. It's like he's been cleared in inverted commas since February.
Six months.
So basically, Man United have had all that time to get their affairs in order, and they should have been.
They didn't even have to wait for them to be cleared.
They could have binned them the moment it happened. And that's what should have happened, really. Is it like he's blotting the club into disrepute? He never once came out and said, "Look, that's not me on the recording." That never happened. So, and again, like, that's all you need. He's not come out and denied that. That's him. So
he said, "I'm not accused of doing things." What's the quote? I don't care. I don't fucking care if you want to fuck me, you fucking twat. I'm gonna do it whether you want to or not.
And
he, you
know, like, explicitly says, "Like, oh, I don't want to do this." And
I don't care what you want.
And then another part of the statement which I found baffling today, and it's like, oh, it was part of a longer recording that provided context, and it's like. First of all, what are you on about? And then secondly, like, this, where is this recording? If you know,
it provides such good context. Yeah, exactly.
What Man United did is they handed this over to business people. And then rather than, again, as you've already said the word, they addressed everybody that would have a say and or would comment on it as stakeholders and not people. You know what I mean? And that's
the whole, like, asking the women's team and stuff, you know, just because they're women. So we'll ask them what they think.
And again, that
just opens them up to hate online abuse.
Exactly. It's like, right, oh, well, I'll ask the women's team if they're comfortable enough to have this guy floating about the, you know, it feels like they were trying everything to get him back into the fold. Whereas it was from a business perspective, I don't think they actually really cared that much about Mason Greenwood as a person. I think they cared about him as an asset.
As a finisher, as an asset.
And that's the problem. And I think, you know, that's really the point, that none of the players stepped up and were like, no, we don't want to share a dressing with this guy. We've heard enough of the record. I don't care if he's been here since. I don't care if he was banding on the streets on the steps of Old Trafford as a baby. He's no longer a welcome in this football club because he doesn't up.
It should be an absolute privilege to play for Man United. It should be the highest privilege.
And again, even as a footballer, to that level, the highest privilege. So why none of the players, as they always do, they're always silent. And again, they've even got Anthony there, who's been accused of all sorts as well. But that's another conversation for another podcast. It's just none of the players have stepped up and said, like, we don't want them in the team. I'll make this. We as people will make this decision for you, and we're like, get them to fuck. We're not sharing the dressing room, and that would have been it. Again, similarly, I think even the women's team, given the, you know, their raised profile over the last few years, if they'd have went, no, we're not having it. You know, it's against the values of Man United. It's against, you know, us as women. Again, I don't speak for women, but you get my point that there would have been various, and I mean, again, as you say, it wouldn't have been fair to put on the women's team to put that, but the men's team should have stepped up there.
United should have just had leadership from day one and dealt with it.
It's always the fucking same, that no one steps up really when it comes to this sort of thing. And again, there's no trial to be had or anything like that, so they didn't need to maintain their silence after the charges were already dropped. They could have went, we've heard enough from the recording. Don't care if there's another recording that provides context. Don't care if there's an investigation that needs to be done. We're not having them in our dressing room.
And the guy that's written this statement will be Man United's general counsel, who will be an incredibly experienced and capable lawyer, but he won't be a criminal lawyer. You know, he'll be a corporate lawyer. So, you know, it's not for him running this process to be saying that he hasn't committed the crimes, because that's not his job. That's not his expertise. Exactly. It's depressing. And now he'll show up somewhere else, inevitably in Saudi Arabia. I think most people think perhaps Turkey, perhaps Greece, but probably Saudi. And get paid a packet, and that'll be fine. And hopefully we don't have to hear about him anymore, which would probably be nice for many people, not just us. Final word on Scottish football. Dunfermline had a week off. Aberdeen, as I said in the intro, beat Stirling Albion 2-1. Made a bit of a meal of it. Got Ross County in the next round, which is fantastic. But more importantly, away to BK Häcken on Thursday. Swedish champions, new look Häcken side. Aberdeen going to the failed Gothenburg, which is obviously so famous in their history. Fortunately, BK Häcken are in the process of selling their four best players this week, so hopefully they'll all be gone by Thursday. That would be nice. And we can play a new look Häcken team. A place in the Europa League group stages at play, but the loser goes into the Conference League group stages, which even for Aberdeen at this stage of the season is... this stage of the season, just in general, sorry, it would be an enormous achievement for them. Hibs and Hearts also did really well last week to get themselves through to the next round of the I think it must be the Europa League qualifiers. So Hearts are at home to Pauk from Greece, which will be an incredibly tough tie in their first leg. And Hibs are playing Aston Villa, which I can't find to hand, but I assume is also a... maybe on Wednesday, is also a Conference League tie. So, it's Hibs at home to Aston Villa. So that'll be interesting, that Scottish v English battle. As much as I always like Scottish teams to do well, particularly against English teams, to save this silly argument that we're a Farmers League and we're all shite, I really, really don't think I can live with Lee Johnson having a scalp against a Premier League team on his resume.
Unai Emery,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. The king of European football. That would... that'd be too difficult to cope with, to be honest.
No, I wouldn't worry. I think I'll get probably double.
It'll be fine. I did think Hibs's post was quite funny, where they said it was a ladder match between Villa
and John McGinn ladder match.
Yeah. That was actually class. That's been good. Mike never did make it. His Wi-Fi must be tatties. But Sheila, we had a wonderful chat. We've kept the time fairly reasonable as well, certainly by our standards. It's been an absolute pleasure. And I look forward to speaking to you again next week. Cheerio.